Now, shall we begin?
When we got organized as a country, and we wrote a fairly radical constitution with a radical Bill of Rights, giving a radical amount of individual freedom to Americans, it was assumed that the Americans who had that freedom would use it responsibly. That is, when we set up this country, abuse of people by government was a big problem. So if you read the Constitution, it's rooted in a desire to limit the ability of government's ability to mess with you, because that was a huge problem. What's happened in America today is too many people live in areas where there's no family structure, no community structure, and no work structure. And so there's a lot of irresponsibility. And so a lot of people say there's too much personal freedom. When personal freedom is being abused, you have to move to limit it. That's what we did in the announcement I made last weekend on the public housing projects, about how we're going to have weapon sweeps and more things like that to try to make people safer in their communities.
The argument is that it's a form of racial profiling.
No, the argument is that we have to take the guns away from these people that have them and that are bad people that shouldn't have them. These are felons. These are people that are bad people that shouldn't be. When you have 3,000 shootings in Chicago from January 1st, when you have 4,000 people killed in Chicago by guns from the beginning of the presidency of Barack Obama, his hometown, you have to have stop and frisk. You need more police.
An earnest and well-intentioned reader, no doubt acting in good faith, posted the following comment to the Pro Libertate blog. The solution to the horror stories wrought by socialist government-run security is security provisioned by consumers on the market, such as Threat Management Center. That's a private security firm in Detroit. They do wonderful work. I've referred to them in the Pro Libertate blog and on this podcast. Now keep in mind, continues this earnest reader, Donald Trump is a great ally in the movement toward free market security. I dare say Trump has a great and positive experience with private security, which safeguard his vast property holdings as well as his own person. As well, Trump views the military as a security service existing to safeguard American person and property, not at all a force to be used by the political class to rule the world. Speaking specifically with reference to Donald Trump's view of the military and foreign policy in general, he is less interventionist than Hillary Clinton. He's also less interventionist than the neocons who have infested the Republican Party for decades. He is also more overtly militaristic than any of these people. He seems to believe that in those circumstances in which the military should be deployed, it must act more aggressively, and that it also must have greater access to what are called public resources. I don't happen to believe in the concept of public resources. But Mr. Trump seems to think that the military is underfunded and underprovisioned, and that it should act more aggressively whenever it is deployed overseas, and that it should be less restrained by the law with respect to such practices as torture and the use of drone strikes and potential retaliation against families of suspected terrorists. That's the same mindset that he brings to the preservation and expansion of the state's domestic security monopoly. I have diligently scoured the public record in a futile search for any statement that Donald Trump has made during his long and very well-documented public career in which he has suggested any sympathy for the idea that security should be provided by the private sector rather than by the government as a monopoly. He certainly does benefit from private security with respect to the management of his own affairs, the protection of his own property holdings and his own person. That much is true. At every campaign stop, Donald Trump undergoes a ritual of conferring benedictions upon the police and urging unqualified support for them. He has won the endorsement of police unions, and those are, of course, the paladins of the government security monopoly, for, among other things, his proposal that as president he would issue an executive order mandating the death penalty for anybody who kills a police officer. not somebody who murders a police officer, mind you, but anybody who kills a police officer. And there are many circumstances in which it is entirely justifiable for a citizen to kill a police officer. Last December 10th, Donald Trump received the endorsement of the New England Police Benevolent Association, which is a union of police and correctional officers, of course, are prison guards, in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. In a speech to a police union crowd in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Mr. Trump said the following: "One of the first things I'd do in terms of executive order if I win would be to sign a strong, strong statement that will go out to the country, out to the world, that anybody caught killing a policeman, policewoman, police officer, anybody killing a police officer, death penalty. It's going to happen, okay? We can't let this go." Legal commentator Matt Ford of The Atlantic magazine points out that there are at least three problems with Mr. Trump's proposal. First, the U.S. Supreme Court forbade mandatory death sentences in 1976 with its ruling in Woodson v. North Carolina. Central to the court's ruling was the justice's opposition to punishing all murderers alike without regard for the aggravating or mitigating circumstances of each case. Second, the death penalty is largely administered by the states, not the federal government. It should not be administered at all by the federal government under the constitutional framework, with the exception of the specific criminal offense called treason, which is one of the very few offenses that fall under the original jurisdiction of the federal government under the Constitution, a document of which Mr. Trump's ignorance is comprehensive, unfortunately. Finally, and most importantly, continues Mr. Ford, the president doesn't have the lawful power to unilaterally impose a criminal punishment on anyone, whether it be a fine, a prison sentence, or death. This is something that Mr. Obama has been doing rather promiscuously through the use of drone strikes, and Donald Trump has said that under his administration, drone strikes would continue to be part of a counterterrorism strategy. He may be the first presidential candidate of any major party to promise that he would pursue a domestic application of that program, not necessarily using drone strikes to target people who kill police officers, but using the executive power of the presidency to dictate the execution of American citizens for specific offenses. Presidents can wield the pardoning power to reduce or remove punishments for federal crimes, but they can neither increase nor enact them, continues Mr. Ford. The American legal system delegates that responsibility to judges and juries. Infringing on that separation of power through executive order would, at minimum, violate the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments' guarantees of due process. Trump has a history of invoking the death penalty without regard for its limitations, recalls Mr. Ford. After the brutal rape of a white jogger in Central Park in May 1989 received widespread media attention and amid a rise in crime rates nationwide, Trump took out a full-page ad in four New York City newspapers with the title, "Bring Back the Death Penalty, Bring Back the Police." I pause here to point out that this is obviously incompatible with the conceit that Mr. Trump is a great ally in the movement toward free market security. He did not specifically reference the Central Park jogger attack in the ad, continues Ford, but its timing made the connection inescapable. How can our great society tolerate the continued brutalization of its citizens by crazed misfits, read Donald Trump's ad. Criminals must be told that their civil liberties end when an attack on our safety begins. That's precisely the opposite of the perspective imputed to Donald Trump by the reader in this comment to the Pro Libertate blog. One other really remarkable thing about Donald Trump's perspective on law and order is that he may very well be the first presidential candidate of any stature who has explicitly called for targeted summary gun confiscation. Hillary Clinton, of course, is a thoroughgoing proponent of civilian disarmament. That is to be expected. I have no doubt at all that Hillary Clinton, had she the means, would seek to disarm most of the public, at least to the extent that this would be practicable. Donald Trump, however, has endorsed what is called micro-disarmament in the relevant literature by endorsing stop and frisk, which is to say stop, frisk, and confiscate firearms. The ultimate private security program, of course, is an armed citizenry, and Donald Trump seems to think that it is an appropriate role for the police to be deciding who will be permitted to keep firearms. And I will have a great deal more to say about this when I return. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Please stand by for more sedition after this.
There's been a lot of violence in the black community. I want to know, what would you do to help stop that violence, you know, black on black crime?
Right. Well, one of the things I'd do, Ricardo, is I would do stop and frisk. I think you have to. We did it in New York. It worked incredibly well. And you have to be proactive. And, you know, you really help people sort of change their mind automatically. You understand.
Whichever of the two figureheads for the contending factions of the establishment party wins the presidential election next month, the next president of the United States is going to be Clintonian with respect to the question of the police state. There simply is not that much substantive difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, who is a longtime friend and political ally of the Clinton family, who only recently discovered that they are thoroughly unacceptable in terms of their positions on the issues and their personal qualifications to exercise power. On April 19th of 1994, which was, of course, the anniversary of the Holocaust at Mount Carmel, then-President Bill Clinton was featured on an MTV program called Enough is Enough, which was an hour-long infomercial for the Omnibus Crime Bill, which was a measure that accelerated the federalization and militarization of law enforcement nationwide, and also called for new impositions on the right to keep and bear arms. During one fascinating exchange, Bill Clinton extolled the supposed virtues of communitarian societies in Asia, such as Singapore. A lot of Asian societies that are doing very well right now have low crime rates and high economic growth rates, partly because they have very coherent societies with strong units, where the unit is more important than the individual, whether it's the family unit or the work unit or the community unit. My own view is that you can go to the extreme in either direction, continued Clinton. And when we got organized as a country and we wrote a fairly radical constitution with a radical Bill of Rights, giving, note the use of that verb, giving a radical amount of individual freedom to Americans, the idea being that freedom is a gift of the state rather than something innate in the individual as a result of the individual's existence, it was assumed that the Americans who had that freedom would use it responsibly. And Mr. Clinton is nothing if not the very soul of personal responsibility. That is, when we set up this country, abuse of people by government was a big problem. So if you read the Constitution, it's rooted in the desire to limit the ability of government's ability to mess with you, because that was a huge problem. It can still be a huge problem, he admitted, not making specific reference to what his regime had done a year earlier to a group of people living in rural Texas. But it assumed that people would basically be raised in coherent families and coherent communities, and they would work for the common good as well as for the individual welfare. Actually, the perspective of the founders, for the most part, there were exceptions, unfortunately, was that the individual should be free to pursue his or her happiness as that individual defined happiness, and that in doing so, this would conduce toward the common good, not that the common good was supposed to be the desideratum of the individual's actions. What's happened in America today is there's a lot of irresponsibility, and so a lot of people say there's too much personal freedom. When personal freedom is being abused, you have to move to limit it. That's what we did in the announcement I made last weekend on the public housing projects, about how we're going to have weapons sweeps and more things like that to try to make people safer in their communities. That, of course, is essentially, pared down to its essence, what Donald Trump is talking about when he refers to stop and frisk. Donald Trump does not couch his proposal in the emasculated language of nanny state liberalism the way that Bill Clinton did. But At its core, it is very much the same proposal. During the September 26, 2016 debate with Hillary Clinton, the first of the three that they had, Donald Trump said that he wants to take guns away from criminals and continued to praise the controversial stop and frisk policy, summarized a CNN report. We have gangs roaming the street, and in many cases they're illegally here, illegal immigrants, and they have guns and they shoot people, he told moderator Lester Holt of NBC News. Badly exaggerating, for the most part, what's going on in this country. There are limited situations that meet that description. It is by no means a national epidemic. Violent crime in general is radically down over the last several decades. And we have to be strong and we have to be vigilant, continued Trump. Right now, our police are afraid to do anything. There are some people who are trying to say that Donald Trump wants to break up the police monopoly and encourage privatization of the security function. I see no evidence for that proposition. Right now, our police are afraid to do anything, Trump said. We have to bring back law and order. Now, whether or not in a place like Chicago you do stop and frisk, which worked very well. Mayor Giuliani is here. It worked very well in New York. It brought the crime rate very down. But you take the guns away from criminals who shouldn't be having it. He's not talking about people who have been convicted of crimes. He's talking about people he regards to be innately criminal in disposition. Stop and frisk, incidentally, had no measurable impact on the violent crime rate because very, very few, a vanishingly small percentage of the contacts through the stop and frisk program in New York City actually resulted in prosecutions of violent crimes or crimes against person or property, or for that matter, resulted in prosecutions for people who were carrying guns who did not have government permission to carry guns, or for whom that so-called privilege had been revoked. One really interesting facet of Donald Trump's perspective on private security is that he often imposes a gun-free zone on his private properties, which is an entirely legitimate exercise of his property rights. This is from ABC News last May 20th. Donald Trump spoke in favor of gun rights at the National Rifle Association convention today, but security and staff at several of his prized hotels and golf courses told ABC News that guests are not allowed to carry guns there. We strongly believe in the Second Amendment and are against gun-free zones. While laws vary substantially from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, we allow security personnel and other licensed individuals the ability to carry a firearm in an effort to protect themselves, our guests, associates, and the general public, a spokesperson told ABC News. There are no restrictions on licensed individuals carrying in our hotels or golf clubs, a Trump Organization official told ABC News. Hotel staff and security personnel at several Trump properties told a different story when reached by phone by ABC. Mar-a-Lago, Trump's posh Florida club, doesn't allow guns, a hotel staff member told ABC News. Trump National Doral in Miami, Florida, doesn't allow guns either, a security official told ABC News. The resort would much rather not have guns on the property, said a security official with a hotel who noted that guns are not to be carried on our property. We've had guests that have brought them before, he said, but those guns had to remain in the safe the whole time in the room. A security worker at Trump National in Jupiter, Florida, said no when asked if guns were allowed on premises by citizens who were licensed to carry them. Asked about exceptions for people like off-duty cops, the staff member directed ABC News to a supervisor who said the hotel had no comment at all on guns on the property. Trump International Golf Club in Palm Beach County, Florida, also doesn't allow citizens with concealed carry licenses to bring their guns on the property, a golf shop worker told ABC News. A security official at Trump International Hotel in Las Vegas would not comment and told ABC News the question would have to be handed over to a public relations staffer. Trump Winery in Virginia told ABC News that it does allow people to carry guns on the premises as long as they're not drinking. This is all a perfectly legitimate exercise of a property right. The National Rifle Association, just in the last couple of days, has lambasted Hillary Clinton, who is somebody eminently worthy of such treatment, for her statements regarding the Heller decision, which struck down several onerous provisions of Washington, D.C. civilian disarmament law. They also pointed out that she misrepresented what Washington, D.C.'s anti-gun ordinance required. The district's ban didn't just require safe storage to prevent access by toddlers, points out the NRA. It made possessing a loaded, usable firearm in the home, including for self-defense, a crime. The crime did not require any proof of access by children or even proof that children were present in the home. D.C.'s requirement that firearms be kept unloaded and disabled, which Clinton now claims to endorse, was also far from reasonable, according to the Heller decision. It made even lawfully owned guns useless for what the Supreme Court identified as their core purpose under the Second Amendment, self-defense. That's a matter of government policy, or at least it was in Washington, D.C. On many of his properties, Donald Trump imposes the same restrictions on the innate right to armed self-defense. The way he has exercised his stewardship over at least some of his private properties suggests that his view of individual armed self-defense is much closer to that of Hillary Clinton than many of his defenders would care to admit. Irrespective of which of these two wins in November, the next president of the United States is going to be Clintonian with respect to police state issues. I will return in just a minute.
I would do stop and frisk. I think you have to. We did it in New York. It worked incredibly well. And you have to be proactive. And, you know, you really help people sort of change their mind automatically. You understand. You have to have, in my opinion, I see what's going on here. I see what's going on in Chicago. I think stop and frisk. In New York City, it was so incredible the way it worked.
In 1995, recalls civil liberties commentator Kevin Drum, the criminologist and political scientist John DeLulio was invited to the White House to attend a working dinner on juvenile crime. President Clinton took copious notes and asked lots of questions, he reported. So, what did DeLulio tell him? In late 1995, DeLulio wrote a magazine article. Specifically, he wrote it for the Weekly Standard, which is the neoconservative equivalent of Pravda, that gives us a pretty good taste. And this is from Mr. DeLulio's article, The Coming of the Super Predators. We're talking about kids who have absolutely no respect for human life and no sense of the future. And make no mistake, while the trouble will be greatest in black inner-city neighborhoods, other places are also certain to have burgeoning youth crime problems that will spill over into upscale central city districts, inner-ring suburbs, and even the rural heartland. This is what he predicted 20 years ago. None of this has come true. The rate of violent crime, mercifully, has declined consistently over the last 5 decades. That decline has become more pronounced over the last 2 decades. According to Dr. DeLulio, they kill or maim on impulse without any intelligible motive. The buzz of impulsive violence, the vacant stares and smiles, and the remorseless eyes. They quite literally have no concept of the future. They place zero value on the lives of their victims, whom they reflexively dehumanize. Capable of committing the most heinous acts of physical violence for the most trivial reasons, for as long as their youthful energies hold out, they will do what comes naturally: murder, rape, rob, assault, burglarize, deal deadly drugs, and get high. Drum continues, it's hardly surprising that this made an impression. A couple of months later, in early 1996, Hillary Clinton, and by the way, it's important to note that this came during a presidential election year. Bill Clinton had made it very clear that he was not going to be outbid on the right by any Republican candidate where it came to the issue of law and order. It's hardly surprising, to continue with Drum's commentary, that this made an impression. A couple of months later, in early 1996, Hillary Clinton gave a speech about her husband's anti-crime agenda. In particular, she noted his efforts against drug gangs. We also have to have an organized effort against gangs, just as in a previous generation we had an organized effort against the mob. We need to take these people on. They are often connected to big drug cartels. They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heel. Rather than getting consistently worse, as I pointed out just a minute ago, the rate of violent crime actually improved. Neither Bill nor Hillary Clinton could anticipate that at the time, and quite frankly, given their political time preference, they didn't care. They were interested in re-election, not in sound public policy. All they knew at the time, comments Drum, was that DeLillo and many others were telling them about a growing number of kids who were impulsive, remorseless, violent, and had no conception of what their actions meant for the future. Does this remind you of anything? Drum inquires. It should. Actually, what this reminds me of, quite frankly, is what we could call the composite character of the super cop. There was no surge in the population of super predator criminals as a result of what was going on in the 1990s. There has, however, been a documentable increase in the number of police officers who meet that description in terms of the way they conduct contacts with the public at large. They've been primed to look upon young people, particularly young people of color, as the expression runs, as potential super predators, and to deal with them on those terms. They've been indoctrinated into a remorseless mindset in which the public at large is seen as an undifferentiated mass of potential criminal menace. And many of them have been through officer safety indoctrination, in which they've been encouraged to indulge every violent impulse upon the slightest pretext without hesitation. One of the programs I'm referring to is actually called No Hesitation. This, in large measure, is an enduring legacy of the Clinton administration a generation ago. What's really interesting is that Donald Trump actually was ahead of this particular curve. Donald Trump is angry about the settlement the city reached this weekend with the Central Park Five, the men who had, as teenage boys, been wrongly convicted in the Central Park jogger rape case and been called animals by just about every institution in this city, wrote Amy Davidson of New Yorker magazine in June of 2014. The rape had been committed between 9 or 10 p.m. on an April evening in 1989. To be specific, it was April 19th. What the hell is it about that date? Someone had beaten the jogger so badly and so brutally that by the time she was found hours later, stripped and covered with mud, she had lost three-quarters of her blood. The police detective on the scene told reporters that her body had already turned cold. She wouldn't have survived much longer. The woman, as she later let the world know in a book, was Tricia Maley, then an investment banker at Salomon Brothers. She had been bashed in the head and remembered nothing. The rest of New York, though, was sure of what had happened to her and those who were to blame. Here was the headline in the Daily News on April 21st, 1989. Wolf packs prey. Female jogger near death after savage attack by roving gang. And the headline from the next day. Park marauders call it wilding, and it's street slang for going berserk. The Times that same week reported, the youths who raped and savagely beat a young investment banker as she jogged in Central Park Wednesday night were part of a loosely organized gang of 32 schoolboys whose random, motiveless assaults terrorized at least eight other people over nearly 2 hours, senior police investigators said yesterday. And she was raped by at least four of the 12 boys, Chief Colangelo said. The five schoolboys who were eventually tried, Antron McRae, Kevin Richardson, Yusuf Salam, Raymond Santana, and Carrie Wise, were all black or Hispanic. And in early May 1989, Donald Trump took out a full-page ad of the Daily News to say what he thought he knew about the case. Trump was on the front page of the papers often enough that season. The Post's split headline marking an end of his marriage would help fill the tabloid space between the teenager's arrest and their conviction, as did Marla boasts to her pals about Donald, best sex I've ever had, which quoted his then mistress and second wife. Soon, there was also coverage of his Baroque business failures. Perhaps he thought it gave him gravitas that spring to weigh in on the character of the teenagers in the park. How can our great society tolerate the continued brutalization of its citizens by crazed misfits? Criminals must be told that their civil liberties end when an attack on our safety begins. And his headline suggested what ought to be done with them. Bring back the death penalty. Bring back our police. The park marauders, the roving gang, the crazed misfits were 14, 15, and 16 years old. The confessions they gave as children had been false, spun out under the pressure of hours of police interrogations. They were, had anyone been ready to acknowledge it at the time, also inconsistent. They also had parents whom they weren't able to see before their questioning. Furthermore, at least two of these young men, as I recall, were actually beaten by police as examples to the rest of them. So they were not merely isolated and then interrogated without the benefit of due process protections. They were actually tortured into confessing falsely to a horrible crime that they did not commit. The boys were sent to prison, continues the New Yorker. One of them, Carrie Wise, who at 16 was the oldest and sentenced as an adult, was still there when, 11 years after the rape in the park, he happened to cross paths with a prisoner named Matthias Reyes. It occurred to Reyes that it was his fault that Wise was there. He confessed that he, and he alone, had raped and beaten Maley, as he had raped other women over the years. He described to police how he had tied her with her clothes. It had been part of his M.O. in other cases, something that gave credibility to his confession. It moved beyond a doubt when a DNA test matched Reyes to the semen found on Maley's body. The DNA hadn't matched any of the teenagers, one of the many details that got blinked over in the trial. They were exonerated 12 years ago, and the charges were formally dropped. One of the interesting things about these supposed confessions is that each of these young men inculpated the others. None of them confessed to his own alleged role in raping the victim. Each of them implicated the others. This is pretty much the same model, by the way, that was used by the Idaho Falls Police Department in the early phases of framing Christopher Tapp for the Angie Dodge rape and murder. Eventually, a $41 million settlement was paid to these young men for their wrongful incarceration. Trump, in responding to that settlement, described it as a disgrace. He referred to it as the heist of the century. He didn't mention Reyes, the confessed rapist. He talked about police blunders as if they were all in the teenagers' favor. The recipients must be laughing out loud at the stupidity of the city, complained Trump. The New Yorker asks, does he imagine that it must be obvious to them, as it is to him, that the decades of their lives weren't worth much anyway? He wrote, these young men do not exactly have the pasts of angels, which is an interesting thing to say. What is Donald Trump's defense and the defense of his adherents in light of the disclosure that he has admitted to being a serial sexual assailant? They say obviously he's no angel. When you're dealing with five young men of color, as the expression runs once again, that expression is used to justify sending them to prison for something they didn't do. When dealing with Donald Trump or other political super predators, that supposedly commends them as people who are worthy of exercising the power to kill and the power to expropriate others in the name of the state. I'll be back in just a minute.
The challenge is to take back our streets from crime, gangs, and drugs. And we have actually been making progress on this count as a nation because of what local law enforcement officials are doing, because of what citizens and neighborhood patrols are doing. We're making some progress. Much of it is related to the initiative called community policing, because we have finally gotten more police officers on the street. That was one of the goals that the president had when he pushed the crime bill that was passed in 1994. He promised 100,000 police. We're moving in that direction, but we can see it already makes a difference. Because if we have more police interacting with people, having them on the streets, we can prevent crimes. We can prevent petty crimes from turning into something worse. But we also have to have an organized effort against gangs, just as in a previous generation we had an organized effort against the mob. We need to take these people on. They are often connected to big drug cartels. They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heel. And the president has asked the FBI to launch a very concerted effort against gangs everywhere. In addition to that, he has appointed a new drug czar. You probably saw him Tuesday night. He's one of the most distinguished active military generals that we have in our country. He's already proven that he knows how to interdict drugs because of his command of the South American activity on behalf of the United States. And I believe it is now time for all of us to know what we can do individually to be part of this anti-crime, anti-gangs, anti-drug effort.
I do want to bring up the fact that you were the one that brought up the word super predator about young black youth. And that's a term that I think was a it's been horribly met, as you know. I think you've apologized for it. But I think it was a terrible thing to say. And when it comes to stop and frisk, you know, you're talking about taking guns away. Well, I'm talking about taking guns away from gangs and people that use them. And I really don't think you disagree with me on this, if you want to know the truth.
Law and order must be restored, proclaimed Donald Trump in an August 17th speech. It must be restored for the sake of all, but most especially the sake of those living in the affected communities. The main victims of these riots, he said with reference to recent riots that had occurred in Milwaukee, are law-abiding African-American citizens living in these neighborhoods. It is their jobs, their homes, their schools, and communities which will suffer as a result. I should point out that the speech was actually delivered in a predominantly white suburb of Milwaukee, not in Milwaukee itself. There is no compassion in tolerating lawless conduct, he continued. Crime and violence is an attack on the poor and will never be accepted in a Trump administration. The narrative that has been pushed aggressively for years now by our current administration and pushed by my opponent Hillary Clinton is a false one, contended Trump. The problem in our poorest communities is not that there are too many police. The problem is that there are not enough police. I pause here to point out that this discussion was prompted by a comment published by a reader of Pro Libertate claiming that Donald Trump wants to privatize the provision of security. He wants to undermine the state's monopoly. More law enforcement, more community engagement, more effective policing is what our country needs, Trump insisted. Just like Hillary Clinton is against the miners, she is against the police. You know it, and I know it. And in fact, nobody who is honest knows any such damn thing. That is certainly not what her behavior as First Lady under the Bill Clinton administration evinced. And that's not what her conduct as senator or as presidential candidate has displayed. The flawed but very useful book, The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, has a chapter entitled The Rebirth of Caste that offers a very good capsule summary of Bill Clinton's career as a law and order politician. In 1992, presidential candidate Bill Clinton vowed that he would never permit any Republican to be perceived as tougher on crime than he. True to his word, just weeks before the critical New Hampshire primary, Clinton chose to fly home to Arkansas to oversee the execution of Ricky Ray Rector, a mentally impaired black man who had so little conception of what was going to happen to him that he asked for the dessert from his last meal to be saved for him until the morning. After the execution, Clinton remarked, "I can be nicked a lot, but no one can say I'm soft on crime." Once elected, Clinton endorsed the idea of a federal three strikes and you're outlaw, which he advocated in his 1994 State of the Union address, to enthusiastic applause on both sides of the aisle. I should point out that during this period, Donald Trump was among Bill Clinton's most emphatic and enthusiastic supporters. The $30 billion crime bill sent to President Clinton in August 1994 was hailed as a victory for the Democrats, who were able to wrest the crime issue from the Republicans and make it their own. The bill created dozens of new federal capital crimes, mandated life sentences for some three-time offenders, and authorized more than $16 billion for state prison grants and expansion of state and local police forces. Far from resisting the emergence of the new caste system, Clinton escalated the drug war beyond what conservatives had imagined possible a decade earlier. As the Justice Policy Institute observed, the Clinton administration's tough-on-crime policies resulted in the largest increases in federal and state prison inmates of any president in American history. Clinton eventually moved beyond crime and capitulated to the conservative racial agenda on welfare, contends Alexander. This, I think, underscores the fact that her analysis is, from my perspective, somewhat flawed. This move, like his get-tough rhetoric and policies, was part of a grand strategy articulated by the New Democrats to appeal to the elusive white swing voters. In so doing, Clinton, more than any other president, created the current racial undercast. He signed the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, which ended welfare as we know it, replacing aid to families with dependent children with a block grant to states called Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. That imposed a 5-year lifetime limit on welfare assistance, as well as a permanent lifetime ban on eligibility for welfare and food stamps for anyone convicted of a felony drug offense, including simple possession of marijuana. I need to point out at this juncture that I do not support welfare of any kind for anybody. And if we're going to be eliminating the welfare state, which would be a course of action I would wholeheartedly support, we should start at the top by eliminating welfare for billionaires and military contractors and entities and people of that description. But there is no constitutional, let alone moral, case to be made for welfare payments of any kind. What happens when you find yourself arrested and convicted of a simple possession crime involving marijuana or some other controlled substance is that you, from that point, are not going to be able to make a living. And so the Clinton approach was the worst synthesis of all the possible alternatives. He put in place a policy that would create people who are unemployable while simultaneously destroying the social safety net. Despite claims that these radical policy changes were driven by fiscal conservatism, such as the desire to end big government and slash budget deficits, the reality is that government was not reducing the amount of money devoted to the management of the urban poor, points out Alexander. It was radically altering what the funds would be used for. The dramatic shift toward punitiveness resulted in a massive reallocation of public resources. By 1996, the penal budget doubled the amount that had been allocated to AFDC or food stamps. That is to say, you still have a big interventionist government that's involved in human inventory control. But rather than doing this in terms of creating welfare plantations, the welfare plantations were becoming prisons. Similarly, funding that had once been used for public housing was being redirected to prison construction. During Clinton's tenure, Washington slashed funding for public housing by $17 billion, a reduction of 61%, and boosted corrections, that is to say imprisonment, by $19 billion, an increase of 171%, effectively making the construction of prisons the nation's main housing program for the urban poor. Clinton did not stop there. Determined to prove how tough he could be on them, Clinton also made it easier for federally assisted public housing projects to exclude anyone with a criminal history, an extraordinarily harsh step in the midst of a drug war aimed at racial and ethnic minorities. In his announcement of the One Strike and You're Out initiative, Clinton explained, "From now on, the rule for residents who commit crime and peddle drugs should be one strike and you're out." The new rule promised to be the toughest admission and eviction policy that HUD has implemented. Thus, for countless poor people, particularly racial minorities targeted by the drug war, public housing was no longer available, leaving many of them homeless, locked out not only of mainstream society, but out of their own homes. As I have stated before, it doesn't matter which of the two figureheads of the two branches of the establishment party ascends to the imperial purple next January. The next president of the United States, with respect to the police state, is going to be a Clintonian. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com and at the newly inaugurated libertarianinstitute.org. I will return in a week, and until then, as always, dum spirito pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and maybe send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.